Self-proclaimed dirty trickster political operative Roger Stone has a history of pulling tricks in South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stone was arraigned Tuesday and pleaded not guilty to 7 criminal counts, including obstruction and witness tampering. Though he may be best known for his national political career, Stone has been involved in local politics, and we'll learn today about his role in Broward Sheriff Scott Israel's campaign. Also, author and speaker Octavia Yearwood went through the foster care system with her share of emotional scars. She wrote a book that she hopes will help other kids who've been through the system, but it's not a typical book. It's an interactive multimedia platform starting to be incorporated in schools. Finally, an artist creates a unique sculpture as a memorial for the victims of Parkland. After 3 months, he plans to burn it as part of the memorial. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Longtime political strategist Roger Stone pled not guilty to a series of criminal charges in federal court in Washington, D.C. yesterday. This came just days after Stone was arrested in his Fort Lauderdale home. He spoke to a large crowd of media, supporters, and protesters following the arrest.
There is no circumstance whatsoever under which I will bear false witness against the president, nor will I make up lies to ease the pressure on myself.
And he was arrested last Friday. Now, Stone has been living in South Florida for nearly 2 decades and has been deeply involved in both local political campaigns as well as national ones. Stone garnered the name the Dirty Trickster for his campaign tactics, a number of which were used in Broward County politics. Joining us now to talk about Stone's involvement in local politics is Brittany Wallman, senior political reporter at the Sun Sentinel. Brittany, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's start by looking at Stone's political history. There's a lot to cover here, but just briefly, let's talk about his connection going all the way back to when it really started for him, President Richard Nixon's campaign for president.
Okay. Yeah, Roger's very proud of his connection to Richard Nixon. Of course, he has a Nixon tattoo on his back. And he got his start there as a young man. He gave a donation to a Nixon opponent that made it appear that the opponent was supported by socialists. So it was just the very start of what would be years and years of campaigning by deceptive tactics.
And he's been part of a lot of different campaigns with people like Reagan and other campaigns that were not successful.
You know, what's funny about, you could try to figure out what campaigns he worked on, but not everyone is eager to raise their hand and say, I had this guy working on my campaign. he mostly worked for Republicans, but he was said to have worked for Al Sharpton. Aside from President Trump, not everybody was proud of getting in the gutter, which is what you often do if you had Roger is willing to do to really skirt the ethical boundaries to get you elected.
So for many years, he lived and worked in Washington, D.C., but what brought him to Florida? And it was shortly after 2001.
Well, he was down here for the 2000 recount and takes credit for the Brooks Brothers riot in Miami to stop the recount so that George Bush could be elected. As with pretty much everything that Stone takes credit for, it's really hard to know the truth or take anything at face value. But he did at one point move from Miami Beach up to Broward. And that was when, we saw him get involved in races here.
Yeah, let's talk about, was it one of Stone's first major campaigns in South Florida was the race for Broward Sheriff. Tell us about his involvement. This goes back to the race with Sheriff Al Lamberti campaign.
That's right. Roger was working for Scott Rothstein, who ultimately was exposed as the biggest Ponzi schemer of our time. And Roger worked there in his law firm, and they were supporting Lamberti's candidacy for reelection. And so in that race, Roger was in support of Lamberti and recruited, he's used some of the same people like person two in the indictment. Randy Cretico was actually involved in that race, as with in many others with Roger, in trying to fool voters into thinking that Scott Israel was supported by the Republicans, which, you know, if you know Brower politics, very liberal voter base, and to be supported by the Republicans is not usually a calling card.
And let's just real briefly who Randy is, because he was part of, and I want to talk about Stone's tactics, but who is this gentleman?
Well, he's a comedian. I think he had a radio show. He's a very good impersonator, and so that is very useful for Roger. One of his favorite tactics in campaigns is called spoofing, where you make it, of course, it was better when everybody had landlines, but you make the caller ID show that, say, the call is coming from the Tea Party, and then you have Randy on the line impersonating you know, George Bush or Al Sharpton, or, you know, he has a whole menu of impersonations that he does. And it's a really sort of cynical approach to campaigning, where you're relying on, you know, almost the stupidity of some voters, or the gullibility, people not researching and just taking, believing calls like that. So he helped out on that.
And that was he was doing robocalls. Stone was doing robocalls, and he was using this comedian to impersonate former President George W. Bush, or, as you said, he's got a list of different people that he could impersonate. And basically, what he was trying to scare voters.
Yeah. For example, Randy Credico has admitted that he impersonated Al Sharpton and telling black voters, "We cannot have Scott Israel as the sheriff." He impersonated George Bush, pretending to endorse Scott Israel so that Democrats thought that Israel, you know, was had the stamp of approval from Republicans. And in that race, they were successful. Lamberti was reelected. And then he switched sides. Roger Stone switched sides in the subsequent face-off between Lamberti and Israel. In this election in 2012, they supported Scott Israel.
Yeah. And this kind of goes back to what you said at the beginning, is that, you know, Stone has worked both sides, you know, when it comes to campaigns, not just the GOP. Do we know what the impetus was, though, why he flipped and then was working to help Israel?
Yes. A good friend of his at the time, Ron Gunsberger, was running Scott Israel's campaign. And so Gunsberger, you know, recruited Roger to his side. And so it was really just that friendship and alliance. And I think, you know, like a lot of political consultants, the challenge is fun. And, you know, so it's not so much ideology in a sheriff's race anyway. Roger really relished probably the challenge, and, you know, they were successful.
Does this say anything about Stone's allegiance to a party, or is it more about securing victories? What does it tell us about him and his motives?
Well, you know, Roger is a libertarian, and in, you know, when you're talking about a sheriff, partisanship doesn't play as big of a role. But what he told us was that, you know, the only real issue he had to lobby a sheriff about that he did lobby about was animal rights. I mean, as has come out in this indictment discussion, you know, Roger is a dog lover. And but I think, you know, he has worked with some of the same people for years, and his friendships are important. And we're now seeing a lot of his circle, you know, those allegiances fall apart because, you know, now it's, you know, it's getting real, and he's been indicted, and, you know, his friends like Randy Credico, you know, he was threatening to take his dog and do who knows what else, according to the indictment.
And just real quickly, I want to make sure that Stone, his son, works at the Broward Sheriff's Office, right?
Yes, that's correct. His stepson, Scott Stone, already was a deputy there. And after Israel got elected, then he was made detective. And he still works there.
Now, you know, we heard anything from Stone, by the way, about Sheriff Israel since the Parkland shooting?
No, I'm not one peep. And he's not friends with Ron Gunsberger, the person that brought him into that, went on to become general counsel at BSO. And since they're not friends anymore, Roger, the last time I had checked in with him in the last sheriff's race, he said he had bigger fish to fry. You know, he's really more interested in the national stage and or any stage, if you know. Mm-hmm. Publicity, all publicity is good publicity, is one of his tenets. But no, I don't know what his feeling is about the removal of Sheriff Israel.
We're talking with Brittany Wallman, senior political reporter for the Sun Sentinel. We're looking at Roger Stone's political history in South Florida with a number of local and national campaigns, most recently for President Trump. Stone pleaded not guilty to in federal court yesterday to a number of criminal charges in the Mueller investigation, including obstruction of justice. So what were some of the campaign tactics that Stone implemented during Trump's run for presidency here in South Florida?
I don't know specifically South Florida-wise, but, you know, another one of his MOs is just to use disinformation. If you saw in the indictment, you know, they talked about, let's tell people that Hillary has dementia. He likes to throw out bombs and also, you know, as we're seeing, he was very successful in getting the media to attach itself to the issue of how many FBI agents raided his house the other day, rather than talking about the merits of the indictment. So disinformation, confusing voters, deceiving voters, it's always hard to tell what the truth is when you're dealing with Roger.
And did Broward County Supervisor of Elections, Supervisor of Elections Brenda Snipes, get ensnared in any way in Stone's political maneuvering?
Oh, yes. I'm glad you reminded me of that. One of the pieces of just fiction, really, disinformation that he threw out there was that Hillary Clinton had met with the Broward Supervisor of Elections. And it was meant to foment distrust and some sort of belief that the Broward Elections Office was going to try to throw the election for Hillary. And of course, it wasn't true. He said, you know, photos to follow. The photos never did follow. Later, he admitted that, oh, that wasn't true. I had bad information. But, you know, some people believe that. There's a certain percentage of people that will believe anything.
He met with the Broward Republicans, and I'm wondering, how did Stone's connections to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange come up in that conversation?
In which conversation?
When he met with the Broward Republicans, I believe that's, is it that when he did that?
Oh, yeah. His first really public mention of having some communications with Assange was here in Pembroke Pines. He, you know, he goes and sells, he has books and he uses a lot of the notoriety to sell books. And he, you know, stated there that he had communications. And then he started making public statements or tweets that intimated that he knew that the Democratic emails were going to be released. And, you know, all the stuff that's getting him in trouble now was first sort of revealed here in Broward at the Republican Club.
Is it possible that any of the political operatives that Stone worked with in South Florida could be brought in as witnesses as this trial ensues?
Well, I mean, there's been some hint of that. I think anything's possible. Those who are really close to it think that, you know, it's going to depend largely on, you know, what Stone does, how much he cooperates, what he knows, you know, what, you know, whether there are going to be more indictments, more subpoenas. So I think we'll just have to wait and see.
Now, Broward County, of course, has long been thought of as a Democratic stronghold, especially in statewide and national elections. But to what extent did Stone embolden the GOP here, or at least expand the political influence of the party in Broward?
Well, you know, even if he did in any way, I mean, let's face it, Broward is still a very blue county. I think that, you know, to a lot of people, Stone is still seen to be a fringe, you know, he's sort of a radical person. And, you know, there was a rally that was planned outside his house last night that was to be supporters. Now, he has fans, but, you know, was it a huge rally? No. I think there were maybe a couple dozen people there. You know, the people that like Roger Stone are, you know, like I said, he's a libertarian. It's a certain, he likes to tout conspiracy theories, and people that distrust the government tend to like him.
Well, Roger Stone again pled not guilty in federal court yesterday to a number of criminal charges in the Mueller investigation. We've been talking with Brittany Wallman, senior political reporter for the Sun Sentinel, learning more about Roger Stone's political history here in South Florida. Brittany, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, still to come, a local author uses technology to connect young readers to her message. More on that coming up on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Local author, educator, performer, and speaker Octavia Yearwood has been very open about her traumatic experiences as a foster child. Her mother suffered from drug addiction, and Octavia was placed in the foster care system where things did not get any better. In her 2017 memoir, How the Hell Did You Do That?, she details how she survived the foster care system, the self-healing that took place years after, and the steps that she's had to take to learn to forgive. Now, the memoir also serves as an educational workbook with a video component. Each chapter has a set of questions at the end in which Octavia is using as a curriculum to help foster youth or people who've been through the similar traumatic experiences. The book curriculum has recently been implemented through a pilot program within two educational organizations in Miami, Urgent Inc. and the Overtown Children and Youth Coalition. She's looking to expand it to other schools as well. And Octavia Yearwood joins us. It is great to have you back, Octavia. Welcome.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Briefly, let's start with just describing the book. Or anybody who hasn't read it, it's a story, your story, but how do you describe it to someone?
I always like to say that it's a guidebook, workbook, and memoir. Because that's exactly what it is. I, when I wrote the book, I thought to myself, what did I need as a youth? What did I need? And what I needed was guidance. I needed more guidance. A lot of things that I learned was on the fly. You know what I mean? Making these mistakes and then learning from them and then processing and then getting better. So I was like, if there are youth that are in these same similar traumatic experiences, I want to provide them with a guidebook, a handbook that's going to help them start to learn these lessons before they have to experience perhaps some of the things I did.
And how did you decide to do it? Because, I mean, there's one thing is to write a memoir and then relive memories, but you're trying to bring it up for people. But you want it, as you said, this is more than that.
Yeah.
This is also to try to be guidance for other people. So how did you come to the decision to do that?
Well, when I first wrote the book, I scrapped the first one. It started kind of wonky. It started like me sitting in my bed and it was raining outside. And I was like, it's raining outside and I'm writing this book. And I felt it was really strange. It was really strange. And then in 2016, I spoke to an elder, Muti Emily, she actually is from Urgent Inc. She's one of the people that, you know, started and running that organization in Overtown. And I said, and she's written multiple books. And I said, Muti, how did you write this book? And she was like, have you ever done mind mapping? And I was like, what is that? And then, boom, sitting there, she's showing me write the big circle and the lines that come off the circles. And then I said, if I'm going to write a book, I have to do this where it makes sense and it doesn't feel like it's just me. Woe is me. I didn't feel like my life was that bad. And I wanted to get into motivational speaking, and another elder told me that writing a book was the way. So I learned from her how to get organize my thoughts on it. And then to me, one of the biggest things that helped me out was I did this Kabbalah workshop called Out of the Darkness. And and they had this book, and it was called "You Had to Do Your Light Work After You Listened to the Audio CDs," and doing that workshop and writing out those answers and being by myself with these hard questions while doing that really showed me how much I grew. And I said I needed to put that in the book as well. I needed to do that in my book as well, with questions that I thought as a person that had been going through traumatic childhoods would need to answer to get them through and to the space of thriving.
Because that's the thing about the book. It's not just, not to say that reading is passive, but it's not just, you're not just reading.
Mm-mm.
You know, you're interacting,
yep,
with the reader at the end of each chapter. And we're going to get to that in a second. But I wonder, what has been the reaction from people?
I've been really, really, really surprised, happily surprised by all the amazing feedback, especially from adults who've read the book and have done the work. And
which,
are,
by the way, this is not just, it's not a young person's book. This is for...
It's not only for, it was made, it was created with young people in mind. It was made with my 16, 15, 14, 13-year-old self in mind. And what did that person need to hear or engage with to get me to where I'm at, but sooner? Like, I'm where I'm at in my 30s. Like, if I'd done the work a lot sooner, you know, I would be somewhere else, I suppose. But I'm always where I'm supposed to be, right? But
well, we could always say that. Like, if I knew back then.
Right,
like,
right.
Like,
but
now,
the response has been overwhelmingly amazing. It has been transforming people's lives right before my eyes. Like, I'm literally watching people shift. You know, one person who's an adult person said, after reading your book, it put a fire underneath my ass. Oops. Gotta beep that out, guys.
You're over. That's okay. You're over excited. I think we're okay with that. You know, but you wanted to point out your experiences in the foster care system. It's still part of the story, right?
Yeah.
It's still an important part of your growth and your personal journey. What specifically, though, did you want to shine a light on in that experience that to help other people?
So for me, I chose... Again, I think that when creating anything that you want to fill a void, you want to provide what is missing, but also you have to pay attention to what you needed. So I focused in on 9 things: the importance of creating works of art, you know, and how therapeutic and important that is to a human being. Forget about if you do finance or if you are a sculptor. Like, art is important for you, for your well-being, for your mental health. Then I went into things like, there's one chapter called Creme de la Creme, which creme de la creme means what?
Well, the best of the best, top of the top.
Best of the best, top of the top. So Creme de la Creme is a book, it's the chapter on friendship. And it's saying that you're going to choose the best of your reflection, because chrome is the metal that you can see your reflection in. So Creme de la Creme, the best of your reflection, is how you're going to approach finding your bestest friends. And so you have to continue to be better, to choose better, to have better around you.
Always be careful what friends you hang out with.
Yeah.
Choose your friends.
Right.
I'm talking with author, educator, and artist Octavia Yearwood. She's recently launched a video component to her self-help book, How the Hell Did You Do That? Her book is a guide, memoir, and workbook for foster youth who've suffered traumatic experiences. And she's launched the pilot program, by the way, with the video component, with 2 educational organizations. And again, as we mentioned, it's not just for youth. It could be for anybody. Let's talk about this video component.
Yes, and I want to just do a little correct
Go
fact
ahead.
Check. Correct. I did not launch a video component. This is a partnership with Video Rehearser, which is a branch from Miami EdTech, which is obviously a tech education company. So Miami EdTech, Carlos Vasquez is who runs it, and he has his Video Rehearser platform that originally was created to help people learn how to interview better.
Ah, I see. Okay. All right.
And he had been to one of my book workshops, knew that I was working on a curriculum, and said that he thought that his Video Rehearser program could be perhaps a good collaboration.
Well, let's talk about how that works. So as you're reading through the book, again, at the end of every chapter,
yes,
you're challenging the reader to think and answer questions beyond just what they've read, you know.
Correct.
And now there's this.
Yes.
So what happens next? I'm a reader. What am I doing?
So if you're a reader who's in the program, who's actually in the How the Hell Did You Do That book program, you have access to the Video Rehearser platform where you, after you read the chapter, you then go onto the platform and you see me and my beautiful face. Ding. You see me there. You see me ask you the question. You see me answer the question, right? Because I think that a lot of times when you ask some, when you ask somebody a question, sometimes people don't know what do you mean by that, right? And if they're just sitting with my book, they won't be able to know what I mean by that. So this is now their opportunity to learn what I mean by that, hear me answer it, and then in the next video after that, it's them. They'll answer the question confessional style.
They videotape themselves.
They will be, it's applicable on your, you can do it on your phone, tablets, computer. They video record themselves answering the question. They do have an area where they can type it in if that makes them feel more comfortable before recording their video. And then when they submit that video comes directly to my email. And I'm able to see the video, and if I feel the need, I can respond to their video. For instance, this is a program that I use that I've been launching with programs that work with youth that are like 15, 16, 13, those age ranges. So let's say one of the kids being a kid, right? They're like, one of the questions is, who am I? And if they're like, click, yeah, I'm just me. You know what I'm saying? I'm just here living my life. That's it. Submit. And they send it to me. And I see the video. I see that they haven't tried. I see that they just trying to just get through it. They don't really feel like being bothered.
You respond.
I respond. Here I come. Yeah. Okay. I get it. Yeah. Yes. You are you. But I need you to dig a little bit more. I need you to give me a little bit more. You saw how I answered the question. Try that format. Try doing it that way. I'm waiting on it. Click. And it goes right back to them. They get a notification that their instructor sent them a video reply. And now they're like, oh, shoot. What she got to say?
Well, the instructor, it's you, the author.
It's me. Yeah.
And then how many times did you get that? How many times? And it sounds like you're going back and forth with people, right? You can go back and forth.
I could, but it's not necessarily necessary. You know what I mean? Because I do want youth to feel like they have a space where they're able to express themselves and not feel like anything they say is going to be nitpicked and responded to. You know, the response is really the response is there too, because we have a mental health specialist embedded in the program. So when things start to come up for the youth and the youth need to have a discussion with someone about it, that mental health specialist is able to engage with them via the platform as well. So there's many uses as to why the video component and the response aspect is there.
Has there been one story, and I know you don't have to share anything personal, but I'm curious if there's one story that really touched you most. I'm sure you run into these from time to time. Somebody's confessional just hits you.
In their videos. I don't want to.
That's all right. No, not to get into anybody's particular story.
Yeah, I feel you. It's just that the program is new, so that means that the youth are limited at this time, and I don't want to share something that may,
right?
You know what I mean? Compromise that.
So real quickly, tell us about these two groups that you're working with. Again, Urgent Inc. and then the Overtown Children and Youth Coalition.
Yeah.
With them again, you're implementing this curriculum. Walk us through again, what they're doing and what's your goal? What do you envision this is going to become?
Well, I think that it's important to create a legacy. And I think it's also important to realize that as an individual person, as a person who's taking on this task of really making an effort to make the world better, you got to also know that you're not going to be everywhere. And you can't be everywhere. So this is a way for me to not only immortalize the work that I want to do with the book and the impact that I want to have on the world, it's also to provide supplemental support to programs that need it. You know, nonprofit organizations get paid a very low amount of money. They're very much bottlenecked when it comes to the funds that they have access to. And then programs like this is going to be able to help them to work on things that their mission may not be wrapped around. You know what I mean? I wanted to create a program that provided true outreach. How are we really supporting their mental health, our youth? How are we really giving them, how are we really shifting what we think mentorship looks like and how mentorship can actually unfold in the classroom? Also how tech with mental health and mentorship can play a role in supporting.
Do you think, it seems like maybe in the time that we're living in, that this is the best way you're going to reach, especially young people? It's got to be through social media. It's got to be through tech.
That's right.
You know, it's not to say books are not going away, or at least we hope they're not.
They're
going
not
away.
Going nowhere.
They're not going nowhere.
They've been here.
But at the same time, it's got to be more than just a passive read. It's got to be interactive. But you've got to have video. You've got to have social media involved somehow if you really want to reach kids.
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting?
Well, absolutely. And one of the students actually, and you can see it, and you'll see him talking in the end of the promo video that's up that you all shared earlier, which was, as kids, he said, as kids, we don't really like to read, but doing it like this allows us to have fun reading, but also make a connection with our teacher. So you asked earlier about what the format looks like with Urgent Inc. and what it looks like with the Overtown Children and Youth Coalition. And what it looks like is I go in and we read the chapter together out loud. So another thing that's important to me is them getting this comfort of reading out loud, you know, raising their self-efficacy is really, I need them to know that they can do it, whatever it is, right? So they're reading out loud together. And then from there, we have a discussion about the chapter. What are the things that stuck out to you? What things didn't you understand? What did you get from that? So that we really understand that they get what's happening here in this chapter. And then they go break out into their own respective areas where they then go into the video rehearsal platform and answer the questions.
The book, again, is titled How the Hell Did You Do That? And again, it's an interactive book, a workbook. And it's not just for youth. It's for anybody. And again, you because they joined the group, and that way they can be part of that the video component, right?
Yes, that the video component aspect is strictly for programs and schools. And yeah.
Perfect. Author, educator, artist Octavia Yearwood. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. You're the best.
I appreciate it. All right, still to come, a Burning Man style art installation's going up, but it will be burned down because it's in honor of the victims of Parkland. We're going to learn more about the artist coming right up here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, beginning this week, people in Coral Springs will start to see the construction of a wooden temple near the old City Hall. It's being built and designed by artist David Best in memory of the victims of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting almost a year ago. Named the Temple of the Time, Best is working with a team of 24 volunteers to finish the project by the anniversary, February 14th. The temple will be up for 3 months for community members to visit and pay homage, and then, in mid-May, it'll be set on fire. Best started burning structures at Burning Man 15 years ago as a way for communities to express grief and remembrance. WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman spoke with Best at an event in Coral Springs last night, just as construction of the temple was getting started.
The whole idea of losing someone and having some pain that you have to figure out what to do with, oftentimes in our society, we don't have places to address that. There's a lot of our churches are failing, our society's failing a lot of people. And people need a place to go to reflect on loss. You know, if you're a young kid and you're not religious, where do you go? And the Hispanic community has made altars and shrines for a long time for people that they've lost to celebrate their lives. And somehow, I think I've gotten influenced by that to understand how to make something for somebody who's lost someone or somebody who has a tremendous amount of grief or anger that they need to figure out what to do with.
So you mentioned Hispanic, Latino traditions. Are there other, is there other historical significance to this process, or is it from other traditions that it stems from?
Well, this is a bit of a controversy because there's a lot of people there's a large percentage of our community, your community, and I'm part of your community now, that question why we're burning it. A long time ago, we used to gather around a fire. You know, it used to be a place where we had ceremonies and where we celebrated. And when we were frightened, we went by a fire and joined together as a community to figure things out. And the fire is not destructive. It's not my way of working. I don't see the fire as destructive. I think I see it as healing and as inviting.
Have you heard from people in the community here who don't support this project, or they're not happy about the idea of the temple burning?
Of course I have. You know, and I understand that. You know, I understand. It's unfathomable to me how someone could wake up in the morning after losing a son or a daughter. You know, I have no expectations of anybody coming up and giving me a hug and saying, "Congratulations, David Best, you're making a temple and burning it." I understand completely their anguish over what I'm doing, and I just...
Why do you think there's anguish?
Why? Because someone's daughter was murdered.
But I mean, why anguish over what you're doing?
Well, I think... I don't know. I mean, I can guess. But I'd rather not guess. I'd rather just say that I understand anybody that finds frustration in what I do. I understand that.
So how did this particular project come about, or how did you want to do, I guess, a memorial for victims of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting?
Well, this came about because someone called me and asked me if I would come and build a temple in Coral Springs. And I automatically said yes. I said, everything I've done in my career has led to this, not just to celebrate and not just for MST, but for the people in Las Vegas, you know, and the people in Texas who've lost children. This is an epidemic that we're faced with in our society right now. This gun madness we have to have some solution.
And why do you say that everything in your career to this point has prepared you for this project in particular?
Because of what's going on in our society right now. Everything. I've addressed temples over the years for people that have had losses. I've worked with thousands of people. Myself and my crew, we've worked with many thousand people, you know, at Burning Man and in Northern Ireland. And this is the time. This is the time to address it here. For the people here, I hope I can make a gift of what I'm doing for some of the people that have had this tremendous loss.
So do you see this project as activism or advocacy regarding gun violence or in favor of gun control?
I'm neutral. I feel it's important for me that I make a non-denominational, non-political temple for someone who believes in guns and somebody that doesn't believe in guns. It doesn't have anything to do with the guns. It's about loss. My role is to build the place for somebody to find some peace in that loss.
Can you tell me about the design for the Temple of Time, the structure that you're getting ready to build here in Coral Springs?
Yeah.
What does it look like if someone wasn't looking at a picture?
I use pretty ornate shapes, so it's an ornate kind of Baroque, chapel-like possibly, somewhat Western religious culture. Possibly mixed with some Balinese stuff. You know, if you were to look at temples in Bali, it might look like a Balinese temple.
It's like a tower, kind of?
It could be a tower if you want it to be. You know, it's not. It's more like I think it looks more like a chapel, maybe, possibly.
And why is it called the Temple of Time?
The Temple of Time. It was first brought to me to... Someone presented the idea of calling it the Healing Temple, or the Temple of Healing. And my wife and I just were aghast. I mean, so pretentious it would be for me to build a temple called the Temple of Healing. How in the world could I be pretentious enough to think I could offer healing to somebody that lost their child?
Do you have any children?
I do. And so it's time. It's only time. That I could offer anyone. You know, it's going to take a long time for people to get their lives somewhat manageable, you know. And it's certainly not my role to try to heal. I'm not capable.
I'm speaking with artist David Best. David has started the construction of a wooden temple in Coral Springs. The Temple of Time is meant to be a testament to victims of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting that happened nearly a year ago. The structure will be up for 3 months and then burned in mid-May through a ceremonial fire. How are you incorporating the feedback from Marjory Stoneman Douglas students or teachers or maybe families of the victims?
Well, I'm an artist, so all the material I work with, and forgive me if it sounds pretentious, this is genuinely from my heart and not from any other place. The people that are the catalysts, their losses are the catalysts for what I'm making, and they're the inspiration. I consider it an incredible honor to share anyone's losses with me. You know, my crew consider ourselves privileged that we get to build something to help the process of healing.
Can you just explain if there are any safety concerns around burning the temple? You know, what, I guess, measures you take to make sure that that is safe for the community?
I've worked with the fire chief and the police department. We're working in developing a fire system, a system for the night that it's burnt. There'll be a fire safety crew. I work with a pyrotechnician who's a specialist in working with large fires. We have crowd control. We'll create a perimeter, a safety perimeter around the fire so that there's nobody can get near it. It'll be a safe perimeter. And I think the fire first responders are coming up with the graphics. Dispatchers have their own logo.
So if there are community members who want to get involved, how would they do that? Is there an opportunity to volunteer?
Yeah, they can. Unless they have a special group that needs a specific time, I'm there from 8 o'clock till 6:30 every night. Every day I'll be working 7 days a week. I've got a crew of 24 working. If someone wants to learn how to use the tool, I've got journeyman carpenters that will teach people. Part of the process, what makes the temple sacred is everybody in your community participating in it. Whoever adds to it is what's going to make it something that belongs to you guys and not me.
That was WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman speaking with artist David Best. We'll have more information on the construction of the Temple of Time at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, why are some big authors coming to Palm Beach County Libraries for free events? We'll have more on that coming up. Welcome back to Sundial. Well, 11 years ago, Palm Beach County Libraries decided to create a program to connect patrons with well-known writers. It's still going strong, and it's expanded in its offerings. The Palm Beach County Writers Live program is about to kick off. We're joined now by Chris Janko from the library system. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So briefly, for anybody who's never been, how do you describe Writers Live?
Writers Live is an awesome in-person experience to sit down with a group of people you know well, also don't know, and see a nationally renowned writer talk on everything from their research methods, their experience in the publishing industry, anything with upcoming movie deals going on, just a real nice exchange to sit down and talk with a writer beyond reading. I feel like you really get to know the authors when you're there.
It's been around 11 years now. How's it grown? How's it changed over time?
Okay, well, I think we've definitely expanded the amount of events that we're offering. You know, now we're running through January through April. This year, I believe we have about 22 events total. When it started, it was a single event, and that just slowly expanded over the years. We're also offering a lot more nonfiction than we did in the years past, a lot more literary fiction, just kind of expanding beyond thrillers and crime fiction, which is great. We always are going to establish that on the lineup. But yeah, we're offering more events. We've kind of expanded beyond just offering a format where there's a, you know, the author talking in a lecture format. We still offer that too, but we've also begun to have more conversational format with a host.
It's not your it's not like a typical like author signing where you're walking up saying hi. You get to talk to the author. Author's telling stories.
Yes, basically. I mean, there's always a period at the end for people to purchase books, get books signed, take photos with the author, of course, but yeah, it's really a look into their approach to the craft. Their writing regiment, you know, often comes up. a little bit of their background.
I've wondered too, is this, you know, because authors will go to specific events every year, you know, because those events have grown in reputation. They have a big reputation. This has been around 11 years now. Has this event grown to the point where authors are now looking for you?
You know, we were lucky and fortunate enough to get a little bit of coverage in the Palm Beach Post last year. They did a pretty nice article. So I heard from a lot of authors in response to that. Some contacts that I've made and that have been passed along to me from colleagues that were previously more involved in the series, they check in with us annually. So, yeah, I think we have a pretty good reputation. Some national writers groups are aware of the series, and we try to work with them a lot, too. So we do hear from a lot of authors. I've heard from a lot of authors in South Florida that are interested in coming to our libraries more too as a part of the series.
Now you have
lots of nice letters.
You online, you could see the list of events. You could see the authors who are coming. I'm wondering from you: is there one or two authors you would love to get for this event, but you just haven't had the luck?
Yes, there's more than one or two, but
okay.
I'd say two off the top of my head. One, which is a big one, and everyone reminds me of it when I do get to interact with folks a lot that attend the events, and I try to get their feedback. Celeste Ng is a big one, and NG, Celeste Ng,
yep.
That we haven't quite been able to get. I'm hopeful. I try every year. And then Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian a few years back.
Okay.
And he's had a book that was turned into a movie with Matt Damon. He's had a book out since then, too, called Artemis. I've tried him for a couple years. He's more of a sci-fi type guy, but he would be a big deal if he came. And he's kind enough to always respond to me in person, which makes me feel nice. But this year didn't work out either.
So, I mean, what are patrons asking for? What do folks want?
You know, we have a pretty wonderful, established audience for a lot of the bigger mainstream names. You know, they love Stuart Woods, and we've had him in the past. Stuart Woods, Celeste Ng is someone that people ask me about a lot. James Patterson, of course. Carl Hiaasen, people of that nature.
And some of these writers, they live down here, right?
Yeah. The ones this year, we have a lot of Florida writers. Not too many from South Florida this time around, though. We have some representation from St. Augustine, Jacksonville, Fort Myers area, Tampa, St. Pete. So I think there's a good handful of Florida writers this year.
And what are you doing to try to win over, you know, younger patrons, bring in, you know, bigger, more diverse crowds?
Well, we're trying to connect with the State College and their creative writing department. We are working with a few authors this year that I'm happy about that I think would appeal to younger readers. We have some bigger names that would fall, I think, under that category.
Do you feel you have to bring in an author young people would really connect with?
Yeah, I think so. You know, someone of their age, you know, for sure. Someone who they could relate to and, you know, hopefully have read or are interested in reading about. I think the trick there to maybe fully actualizing this connection is really getting the word out in the proper avenues. So I'm glad to be here on the radio station. I don't know if you have a younger listenership, but also, you know, if we're distributing a lot of our materials at the events themselves, we're basically inviting the people to return.
Yeah.
So really exploring new avenues of getting the word out, and a lot of that is just come from me talking to people, emailing out the flyers to writers groups.
It's rolling up the sleeves and just getting out there. All right.
Yes.
Well, Chris Janko, again, from the Palm Beach County Library. Just a reminder, Palm Beach Writers Live is now in its 11th year, and it is going from now through April. So, again, just we'll post it up on Facebook and Twitter. Check out WLRN Sundial so you can check out the schedule to see who is coming and who to check out. Chris, a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. And if I could just mention, if you go to pbclibrary.org, the entire lineup is right there. You'll see a big Writers Live logo right on our homepage, and you could pre-register for the events there and learn a little bit more about the authors. It runs all the way through April. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Thanks, Chris. All right, that's our program for this Wednesday, January 30th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.